Welcome to Securing America with me, Frank Gaffney, the program that's a kind of owner's manual for protecting the country we love against all enemies, foreign and domestic, to the glory of God and his kingdom. We're going to take a deep dive in one of the fronts that we are fighting, whether we know it or not, in what I think of as the war for the free world, in which what is at stake is really not just our own society, our own constitutional republic, but really freedom more generally. And it is under assault, make no mistake about it, from enemies, well, foreign and domestic. And they're using a variety of techniques. The Chinese call it unrestricted warfare. That's a pretty apt term. But some of the facets under which we find ourselves being attacked involve psychological assaults. And we're going to visit for a full hour today with a great friend and very valued colleague who has studied this closely, going back to her time as an analyst in the Central Intelligence Agency, when she was helping our country comprehend and counter Soviet propaganda during the Cold War. She has gone on to a number of other very important roles, notably as a senior contributor to The Federalist, and most recently as the author of an important new book, The Weaponization of Loneliness: How Tyrants Stoke Our Fear of Isolation to Silence, Divide, and Conquer. Her name is Stella Morabito, and I am very pleased to say Happy New Year to you, Stella, and welcome to Securing America. It's great to have you, and thank you for giving us so generously of your time to talk about, among other things, the weaponization of loneliness.
Well, thank you so much for having me, Frank. I really appreciate it. And Happy New Year to you, too. May it be a year of turning points in the proper direction.
Amen. Well, as I'm fond of saying, against all odds. Stella, we're having a little bit of technical challenges today, and as a result, we may wind up cutting back and forth between your live video and a fixed picture of you. I hope our audience will indulge us because the content is going to be riveting and the audio is coming through unimpaired. Let me start by asking you to sort of set the stage for our conversation by talking about a couple of terms that you use. Loneliness being the most obvious, but it's got a couple of different aspects to it, including something you call virtual solitary confinement, which is a very interesting term. This seems to be very much a phenomenon of late in connection with the COVID pandemic and our response to it. But, paint the broader picture for us, and then we'll get into some of the particulars.
Thank you, Frank. Yes, when I say virtual solitary confinement, I'm really talking about that sort of intense primal fear that all human beings have of being isolated, cast into the outer darkness, if you will. Mm-hmm. That fear of ostracism, really. And that's really just tied to our need as human beings to be connected with others. It's very unnatural to be in a state of isolation from other people. We're hardwired to connect with others. And so the flip side of that is that we have a very primal fear of being ostracized. And this is really, I think, the greatest vulnerability that we have to those who are conducting psychological warfare to try to shut us up about what we believe and maybe make us lie about what we really believe. And that's really central, in my view, to all of the destructive agendas that have come crashing down on this country over the past several decades. And I would add to that that this is really the common thread, the common denominator, in my view, of all of these really destructive agendas, whether it's critical race theory in the schools or gender ideology and the corruption of all of our institutions, including medicine and the military and places that we you know, as Americans have over the years, you know, trusted that would not, you know, fall victim to subversion. But it all happens, in my view, it's all tied together by censorship, particularly self-censorship, that happens through political correctness and what I call the machinery of loneliness. And one of the components of that machinery that tyrants use to shut us up is political correctness, as well as identity politics that divides us and mob agitation that enforces that self-censorship. Imagine if millions of people were having billions of open conversations. We wouldn't be in the state we are today. And so I think that that's really what ties it all together. And rather than playing whack-a-mole with 1,000 different agendas, I think if we focus on breaking through the self-censorship, we'd be in a much better position.
We're going to drill down, as I say, on several of those ideas that you have. And let me just say, you're one of the most interesting and thoughtful public intellectuals I know. And I think what you've done here to try to capture something that I suspect at some level, maybe a very primal one, we're all aware of, but may not be consciously so. So we're going to be trying to pull that to the fore so that we can think our way through it and then figure out what are the corrections that need to be taken. But to start with, you set the stage for this conversation by addressing the history of utopian revolutions. And we're going to talk about both, you know, the sort of the people side of this and then the leadership side of this phenomenon. But has any of those utopian revolutions worked out?
Oh, they never do. The only question is how much damage they do before they eat their own. And of course, today, I think we're witnessing, you know, through all of the, you know, the technological advances with the internet and communications technology, artificial intelligence, blah, 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 all that stuff. And its global reach, which is new. These old utopian revolutions they talk about in the book, the French Revolution, the Bolsheviks, the, you know, Mao's Cultural Revolution, Hitler's Third Reich, those were all kind of limited to geographic areas and had a specific charismatic leader, you know, so to speak, you know, that they, you know, they all had these differences. Well, today we're seeing differences with the technological reach, the global reach, and the fact that it's so hydra-headed. I mean, it's coming from so many different directions, whether it's the corporate world, the big media, big tech, so many talking heads, and then the mobs on social media. It's coming from so many different directions. So we're dealing with a much more hydra-headed beast today. And it is obviously, if you look at this Great Reset idea, I mean, this is has all the features of this whole utopian revolution idea, which includes a coercion.
And hold that thought, because that's precisely where I want to come back to. The globalist quality of these utopian ambitions of the moment is, I think, a very distinct, you know, sort of evolution of the problem from the regional to something far bigger and far more ominous. And the character of every single one of these that you have to coerce people to conform is the point on which I want to pick up with Stella Morabito, the author of The Weaponization of Loneliness. Stay tuned, we'll be right back.
This is Frank Gaffney with the Secure Freedom Minute. President Biden and his Mexican and Canadian counterparts have been dubbed the Three Amigos. We should call the scheme he announced on the eve of their meeting this week the 360,000 Amigos. That's the number of aliens expected to be brought here this year from four deeply problematic countries through a gambit that is arguably illegal and certainly unauthorized by Congress. As first revealed by the author of Overrun, Todd Benzman, the administration is now enabling people who would otherwise have paid cartels to smuggle them into this country to skip that expense and grave danger. Instead, they'll be authorized in their home countries to lawfully migrate, then flown here equipped with work papers and money, all at U.S. taxpayer expense. This process may obscure but will only exacerbate today's border catastrophe. Court-ordered injunctions and impeachment proceedings can't come soon enough. This is Frank Gaffney.
We're back. Stella Morabito is in the house with us virtually. We're delighted to have her with us. We're talking about her very important new book, The Weaponization of Loneliness, which is a serious study of how tyrants, as she puts it in the subtitle, stoke our fear of isolation to silence, divide, and conquer. All of which is a way of describing coercive techniques, isn't it? And The point being that I think it's been observed about these utopians that you can't get people voluntarily. They may in some instances vote for one of these charismatic leaders one time, but fundamentally what is involved has to be compelled by force or the threat of force, does it not?
Absolutely. And if you look at these utopian revolutions of the past and you compare them with what's going on today with this whole globalist movement, the Great Reset and so on, you'll see that even though the ones of the past lack the technologies or lack the reach that's global and all of that, they all have in common, past and present, the same kinds of patterns, the same kinds of goals. The patterns always involve what I call the three-legged stool of tyranny, which today we can call them identity politics, political correctness, and mob agitation. Now, even though they're during the French Revolution, they didn't call it those things, you certainly had it. I mean, especially, you know, you had the mob enforcement of the Reign of Terror, the Jacobin Reign of Terror, and so on and so forth through all of these revolutions. Well, it's the same today. Censorship is an absolute requirement of these tyrants, these totalitarians. They cannot abide any kind of dissent, whether it's active or passive. And if I may just kind of parenthetically bring up an excellent course on this that had a huge impact on me. There was a professor who put together a course called Utopia and Terror in the 20th Century. Vejas Ulevichus at University of Tennessee. Anyway, that point I think that he makes is absolutely vital to understand, that they cannot abide any dissent, whether it is active or passive. And that's why you have so much legislation that focuses on censorship. If you look at the Equality Act, for example, it's all about censorship. It's all about denying the right to speak your mind, in the name of anti-discrimination and so on. But my main point is that the goals are always to create this sort of almost mechanical society in which everybody thinks exactly alike.
So Stella, you've laid out a kind of template for how this is done. It has historically been done by foreign enemies of freedom. But you're talking about the Equality Act. That, of course, is legislation here in the United States adopted by our representatives in recent years, and others pieces of legislation like it. And they have, again, as you've put it, sort of this coercive emphasis. These things become illegal to transgress in some form or fashion. Censorship of speech, censorship of behavior of some kind. And I think it's fair to say that whether that is self-censorship or whether it is the power of the state compelling you to do it, really doesn't matter. It's more efficient, I guess, if you can force people to censor themselves than otherwise.
Yeah.
But your point, your overarching point, is that what we have seen before is nothing compared to what technology makes possible today, mm-hmm. in terms of both monitoring, surveilling,
right.
and enforcing such censorship. No?
Oh, yes. Yeah. Now, and self-censorship, as we have sadly practiced over the past several decades in the form of political correctness, where people are afraid, even if they know somebody that they trust and like, they're so fearful of saying something that might be construed as politically correct, incorrect, that they shut up about it. And that creates what's called the spiral of silence in society, so that what may very well be a majority viewpoint ends up looking like a minority or even fringe viewpoint, especially when a media monopoly gets hold of that. So it's, self-censorship, when we do that, we need to understand that we're doing all the heavy lifting for tyrants, so that they can come up later on, which they have done with the so-called Misinformation Governance Board. So they can do a lot of this top-down censorship because we've made it very easy for them through our decades of self-censorship and obedience to political correctness. Why do we do it? Because we're so fearful of the demoralization, the humiliation, the ridicule, the ostracism that may fall upon us if we don't comply with it. And the biggest irony of all is that when we do comply, people think they're getting relief from isolation. All they're doing is pushing themselves further down that cliff or to the edge of that precipice, where we end up with definitely top-down censorship. And we get it, we help pave the way. And so, the reason I wrote the book was to develop, you brought up before just an excellent point, that we all instinctively understand these things. Maybe we don't want to say something because we're afraid we're going to offend and so on and so forth, but we don't have a conscious enough understanding of how these dynamics work and how easily they are exploited, and how much it actually, through our fear of isolation, when we comply with it, we push ourselves, this is the big paradox, further into isolation and atomization and that virtual solitary confinement. So we've got to snap out of it. We've got to build these counter strategies to deal with that.
Well, I want to come to some of those corrective steps in a moment, Stella, but just to drill down on sort of some of these key tenets. This idea that loneliness and your fear of loneliness is something that tyrants can exploit as they maximize the pressure on you. I think a term that's often used for this is othering of people to fractionalize the community and maximize the sense that you have to conform and submit in order to not be lonely. You touched on this a moment ago, and just to tie it in, the stories, the evidence that is now developing, in particular from Elon Musk's revelations out of Twitter, of the collaboration between this private sector entity and presumably the other social media platforms too, let's face it, on the one hand, and the government. You mentioned the Disinformation Governance Board. That's just apparently been one of the entities. The FBI and others have been involved, as you know. This really takes the problem to a whole new level, in terms of the maximization of the pressure to conform, doesn't it?
Oh, yeah. No, you've got every single institution trying to you know, push people into conformity. You know, just the other day, Jordan Peterson was informed by some, I don't know, Canadian tribunal of some sort that he was going to lose his license to practice psychiatry if he, or psychology, if he didn't go through some sort of re-education thing. Mm. Well, he was being used, it is being used as an example to strike fear into the hearts of everybody else.
Important. Hold the thought. The othering is all about making examples of people so that everybody else wants to avoid their experience. Stella Morabito is with us. We'll be continuing our conversation with her on the other side of this very short message. And I hope you'll stay tuned, because one of the things I want to drill down on with her is identity politics and what it means for you. I'll be right back with more right after this.
And throw Molotov cocktails in an effort to destroy police stations, federal courthouses, and local businesses, all in the name of anti-fascism. Most Americans are now, sadly, all too aware of the movement known as Antifa. But where did they come from? What do they want? And how do we stop their campaign of violent mayhem? The Center for Security Policy Press is proud to present Unmasking Antifa, Five Perspectives on a Growing Threat. This new book looks at the history, ideology, organization, finances, and strategy of Antifa, and provides an in-depth analysis for law enforcement officers, policymakers, and the general public. From street fighting tactics of the Black Bloc to fundraising by prominent left-wing foundations, Unmasking Antifa is the go-to guide to understand this elusive and dangerous threat. Get your copy of Unmasking Antifa, Five Perspectives on a Growing Threat at Amazon.com.
We're back with the author of The Weaponization of Loneliness, a fabulous study of how tyrants utilize things like our fears of isolation to silence, divide, and conquer. And I highly recommend this book to you. It's a necessary prism through which to understand what's happening in our society, not just elsewhere around the world. And Stella, you touched on this political correctness. Mm-hmm. And in passing to get to that, you mentioned identity politics. And this is a term that's bandied about all the time. It's clearly being widely practiced. How would you define it? And in particular, tie it to the point you make in your book of that title in connection with the resegregation of Blacks.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's identity politics is definitely about dividing us and segregating us in so many different ways. You know, they use demographics, and usually in the guise of trying to repair damage that had been done in the past. And we all know that certain demographics, like Blacks in America, for example, and women, you know, who've been abused, you know, that you can go through the list. And so that, you know, discrimination has always, in this country anyway, been used as an excuse by certain circles to, you know, get more power. I mean, like, you could see how the move for civil rights was hijacked by the so-called marriage equality agenda. It goes on and on. It's very, basically very useful to hijack these legitimate pushes for civil liberties, you know, to get other agendas pushed through.
Let me ask you, because this doesn't come out of nowhere. Isn't it accurate to describe this divide and conquer strategy as a hardy perennial of Marxism?
Oh, yeah. Yeah. I mean, you know, Marxism began, the haves versus the have nots. So, you know, being, inequality and so on and so forth. It goes on and on. Yeah, it's very old. It's a very old tactic for dividing and conquering and using, you can go back to Alinsky from the 1971 Rules for Radicals, use the goodwill of the middle class or the goodwill of Americans against them. Yes. I mean, it just doesn't get more hostile than that.
Yeah.
And so,
satanic, I would argue. And
yes,
Rules for Radicals was dedicated to Lucifer, as I recall.
Oh, that's true. That's right. That's right. Yeah. Mm-hmm. It just raw power mongering is really all it is. Yeah. If we can see it that way, and
that's the underbelly, the nasty underbelly at that of this utopian stuff,
right?
It's really fundamentally about taking utopia away from people rather than assuring they enjoy it.
Yeah,
nobody else.
Well, any hope for civil society? That's right, in which people can, seek truth and pursue happiness and all of that. No, it all has to have this top-down control, in all these utopian revolutions. But getting back to what you were saying before about, quote, othering, which is a word that the left uses a lot too, but you know, it has that kernel of truth, definitely, by those of us who have felt othered by the left, who are not just have felt it, but have been. And what's central to identity politics is demonization. Mm-hmm. You know, they divide each group. Oppressors versus victims, oppressors, and they categorize it. And so demonization is key to that. And you really want to try to nip that in the bud whenever you can. It's been going on way too long in this country. The end point, the end game of that, if it's allowed to run its course, as it has in history too many times, it ends up in some very nasty, horrific places. And so we have to get control of that. But demonization is really the use of words, language, slogans, and they've got a whole slew of them. If you express your opinion, or even ask an innocent question about something that would be considered politically incorrect to ask about, you can be called a bigot, a hater. The list is just endless. You know, it goes
even failing to get somebody's pronoun right is now.
That's right. Yeah, I mean, it goes on and on and on. It's never ending. I mean, the various phobias. Pick your phobia, or conspiracy theorist happens to be my personal favorite that they just bandy about when you're right over the target. Election denier is a new one. All these kind of deniers, climate denier. You know, they go on, but they always use a legitimate source, like, for example, Holocaust denial, and hijack that to, push for these demonization slogans like climate denier but people just want to explore where the truth really is and look at the facts. That's just not accepted because that gets in the way of, these totalitarian agendas.
And the control that they are intent on exercising at all
absolutely
costs. Hence that coercion, hence that self-censorship, if they can get things to that point, all designed to enable that consolidation and maintenance and exercise of power. at the end of the day. Another technique which you've written about and you mentioned is sort of the third of the three in that troika, the identity politics, the political correctness, and the mob.
Mm-hmm.
Talk us through how the totalitarian utilizes and weaponizes the mob, and how does that tie into this loneliness piece?
Okay. Well, first of all, this, core of tyrants and totalitarians is really minuscule. I mean, we all may have a totalitarian impulse, but those who kind of rise to these levels of power are really not, in terms of a section of the population, they're quite the minority. So they absolutely need to enlist mobs to do their bidding, and they always do. The Jacobins did in the, during their reign of terror in the French Revolution, the Bolsheviks did, and they use youth, like the Bolsheviks use the Komsomol, to spread terror. And Mao, this is an excellent example of identity politics, used the struggle session during his Cultural Revolution.
Right, the Red Guards.
Beat and ridicule. He used mobs of youth, Red Guard. And you can see how with what I call the cultivation of ignorance in education, especially K-12 education, of course, higher education too, is being used to, in a sense, isolate youth to the point that they don't feel they have a purpose and they can't really figure things out. And in order to be accepted, they feel, or not be rejected, they are very susceptible to this kind of mob activity. And especially because there's so much brokenness with families and institutions of faith and community, there's less and less for them to fall back on, for support.
That's not an accident, comrade, as the Soviets used to say. That is by design. And again, I think this has a lot to do with sort of Marxist tenets and lines of attack. And Alinsky, was a master at exploiting it, as was Mao and most of them. So many different directions to go here, Stella. I want to make sure we try to cover them all. But just on completing the thought on the mob, you're talking about people joining in, I guess it's been called mass formation psychosis by Desmet and Malone and others, but finding in their participation in something bigger than them, even if it's an unruly or even violent mob, an antidote to the loneliness and the despair that attends it. Have I got that right?
Yeah, no, I mean, that's why people join cults. It's why they join mobs. It's why they join gangs. They don't have that, those cohesive, natural, bonds that we were created to enjoy, family, faith, friendship, true community, not this manufactured globalist community village thing that they talk about.
Identity.
So when you look at, for example, you mentioned Marxism, the Communist Manifesto. I mean, we're going on 200 years now, 1848. One of its prime central points was that the family needed to be, quote, abolished. And it's a big slogan in there, abolish the family. And then you get religion is the opiate of the people. Why? Because these are forms, these are bonds of loyalty that give us all inner strength. They give us the strength to resist tyranny. And of course, tyrants can't have that. And that's why their main target is are these bonds.
Okay, we're gonna come back to both of those really key points. Targeting sources of addressing loneliness that are actually healthy and empowering and at odds with the tyrant's agenda. Stella Morabito is going to walk through all of that with us on the other side of a short break. Stay tuned. Thanks for tuning in to Securing America with me, Frank Gaffney. If you find the contents of this program to be informative and valuable, I'd like to ask you to consider playing a part in supporting the organization that makes Securing America possible, our Center for Security Policy. We call the center the home of the special forces in the war of ideas. We feature such warriors daily on Securing America as they diagnose the dangers facing our nation, develop strategies for thwarting them, and work with other veteran national security practitioners, legislators, and the American people to execute those strategies. Thanks to our friends at Salem Media, we're able to expand greatly awareness of the Center for Security Policy's efforts and their impact. Like the real special forces, our effectiveness depends on having the ammunition, in our case, money, to perform our mission. Please consider making a tax-deductible contribution at securefreedom.org. Thanks. Welcome back. We are speaking for this full hour, and I hope if you are just tuning in now that you will go back and listen to the beginning three segments with our guest, Stella Morabito, the author of The Weaponization of Loneliness, in which she talks about how tyrants use techniques to divide and conquer us and to submission, and how this is present in our society today. And Stella, again, I mentioned at the outset, we haven't really come back to it, but so much of this seems to have been catalyzed to an extent that I think most Americans would have found unimaginable by the adoption, speaking as we have been, of Marxism, of the China model in response to the COVID pandemic that the Chinese Communist Party unleashed on us, I believe, as a biological weapons attack. But the damage done to families, the damage done to faith communities whose churches have been locked down, for example, the Black Lives Matter agenda of explicitly destroying the nuclear family, right out of Marx. The othering of people who cling to their faith. Or Christian nationalists, as they're being called now, symbolists. All of these are not abstractions any longer. This is not the musings of some distinguished public intellectual. You are observing what is happening in America right now, and warning of where it takes us if we don't take corrective action. And in our last block, we're going to talk a little bit about your recommendations as to what those corrections are. But just tease this out a bit more, if you would. If the Marxists of Mao's strain, with Chinese characteristics, as they say, have in fact perpetrated on this country a model for contending with the social distancing and the lockdowns and the masks and the vaccines and all the mandates and all the digital technologies now for monitoring and enforcing those mandates, they've made huge strides in the direction of taking out families, taking out faith communities, taking out other institutions, taking out our First Amendment and other freedoms of our Bill of Rights, our Constitution itself. No.
Yeah, well, before COVID even happened, we saw lots of headlines about a loneliness epidemic, about deaths of despair. I mean, we had already been feeling the isolation for decades. And the COVID just fast-tracked a lot of that. And yes, you're right, the mandates, unbelievable that we would come to this point for those of us who had not been paying attention, unbelievable. yeah, and who also value our freedom.
Yes.
So, for example, you know, anti-vaxxer became another slur word, another mm-hmm. smear to force you into submission. And it created a lot of surveillance and a lot of hostilities between families. I mean, some families you couldn't get together for Thanksgiving if you didn't, you know, you weren't up on your booster or whatever. I mean, I think we should take it all looking back. I mean, because obviously this is just the start of what is obvious to you and me, I'm sure, a social credit system that is.
Exactly.
You know, being planned that if you don't comply with the narrative, you don't have access to, you know, you couldn't even go to a restaurant or concert if you didn't show your papers right. during that era, which I'm sure they want to bring back big time. But we should look back on it, look forward, but look back at as an object lesson as to what could happen, if it gets worse, if they have their way with the social credit system, that it's very obvious yeah. they want to put it in place. Otherwise, you have mandates, you lose your job if you don't get an injection that's mm-hmm. been an experimental injection. I mean, these yeah. are...
this really comes to... I think the point where I believe all of this is driving us, the institutionalization of these control mechanisms. Mm-hmm. You referred to the social credit system, of course, which is the Chinese Communist Party's term for it, but they've exported it. And I think they've actually built it into this model, China model, with the help of the World Health Organization, that's actually pushed it on countries all over the world, including ours. But mm-hmm. we've come up with a term. Our friend and colleague Reggie Littlejohn, I think, was the first to coin it, of the digital gulag.
Oh yeah.
As a means of essentially rendering all of this permanent and irreversible, and when you add on top of it the vaccine passports and your digital health cards and all of the information that can be put on them, and then the central bank digital currency, mm-hmm. which mm-hmm. becomes another form of enforcement mechanism, where
yes.
essentially your digital bank account can be terminated at the will of the government because you have done something they disapprove of or for whatever mm-hmm. other reason. All of this is chilling because,
yes.
again, I want to just emphasize, this is not hyperbole. This is not the ruminations George Orwell wrote 1984, decades before, sort of envisioning something. This is in our time.
Yeah.
And fast being, as I say, insinuated into our own country. This brings me to the point that I want to get at with you in the next block, and we're going to take a final short break with Stella Morabito. And that is, with the clarity that you bring to this topic in the weaponization of loneliness, Stella, and in your writings, by the way, at The Federalist, which I also commend to our audience, you're putting us on notice that this is where we're headed. But it's still possible, I think, that it can be otherwise. If we are alive to the danger, if we understand it properly, and if we take some practical steps, which mm-hmm. we're going to discuss with Stella Morabito on the other side of this very short break. I hope you'll stay tuned for this, because this is where the proverbial rubber meets the road. If we don't take corrective action, we may be in for a very bad time at the hands of the tyrants who will other us. Stella Morabito on the other side. Welcome back. And a special welcome once again to our guest, Stella Morabito, a Central Intelligence Agency analyst back in the Cold War, who studied closely how the tyrants of the Soviet era propagandized and sought to impose their influence on others, the techniques they used to control their own people, but also to disinform and manipulate and ultimately dominate the rest of us. Fortunately, thanks to my old boss, Ronald Reagan, that didn't come fully to pass. But the tyrants have not gone away. If anything, I think what Stella documents very compellingly is the means by which they can advance their control, their disinforming, their forced submission have expanded enormously. I mean, Orwell, I mentioned earlier, probably in his worst day, couldn't have conceived of something as comprehensive as the Chinese social credit system. Stella, with all of that said, talk about, I think you put it, putting a wrench in the works of all of this. How do we do that? How do we spare our country, our children, our children's children from the fate that seems to be yawning before us over that precipice, as you put it?
Okay, well, yeah, it's a tall order because we've gotten in so deep, but I believe that pessimism is lethal. You know, you've got to be optimistic about how to get out of these things. And I think there are many paths to do so. And in fact, Václav Havel, in his great essay, 1978, called The Power of the Powerless, makes a point of that, that we need to recognize, I think, three things. First of all, the psychological warfare is ancient and it's eternal. Just as the adage, the price of freedom is eternal vigilance. Mm-hmm. It's true. We just have to accept that. We have to come out of our complacency that, yes, we live in a free country, but we've got to come out of our complacency that it'll just stay that way if we let our guard down. You know, tyranny, unfortunately, is the default position. What our founders did, what our framers did with this Constitution, especially that First Amendment that says Congress shall make no law abridging freedom of speech, religion, that means of thought and association and everything, the press. Mm-hmm. That is really a miracle that we have that. In order to preserve that, we need to be aware that preserving it is a constant task. So that's number one. Number two is free speech is a use it or lose it proposition. You can't just keep shutting up about what you believe or lying about what you believe and expect that you're not going to drive yourself deeper into isolation and censorship. Mm-hmm. And number three is that the grand prize of totalitarians has always been those personal relationships that we forge in families, in our faith communities, in true communities, friendship. This is the big prize. This is what they've always been after since Marx and Engels wrote Abolish the Family and the Communist Manifesto back in 1848. We need to become a whole lot more aware of that, that that is where the power of our power really lies, because that is the big prize. That is what they are after. So we have to cultivate and guard our families, our communities, our faith communities, our churches, and say, you know, damn the torpedoes, full speed ahead, and reach out as well, because there's so much brokenness. There's so many people who cannot, come up against this sort of thing. Like we talked about youth who have been deprived of strong family bonds and community and faith. And so it's upon those of us. And it doesn't take that big. It doesn't take a huge majority. It just takes leadership. It takes leaders to be in those first followers to create what Solomon Asch called partnering. When he did his conformity experiments, he said that when one person in that group spoke up, so that the subject of the experiment knew he had a partner, his conformity dropped like a rock. Mm-hmm. So you puncture that illusion of unanimity that everybody's going along with this totalitarian scheme, because that's really what it is. It's an illusion. And you do that by building what Havel called the parallel, or Benda, his colleague, called the parallel polices, parallel institutions that can eventually take the place of these totally corrupted institutions. Homeschooling is a good example of a parallel, an institution parallel to the corrupt K-12 educrats.
Yeah. Government schools, as they say. Yeah. Right. We're almost out of time, Stella, and it kills me that the time has gone by so fast, but I did want to just finish with this thought. You've touched on it repeatedly, and I think properly so. Faith being one of the things that is part of that big prize, as you put it. This is, at the end of the day, I would argue, a manifestation of spiritual warfare.
Yes.
You've mentioned demonic, diabolical. That's going on here. And I think if we understand that and we recognize that the antidote is faith, is belief in some higher power that actually has granted us, as it says in the Constitution, you know, those God-given rights. It's vital that we start from that premise and we defend our position with the benefit of God's grace, I pray. And I just want to say thank you for helping tie so much of this together, from the despair and the loneliness and the design behind it, diabolical though it may be, and the imperative need for us to recognize before it really is too late to take corrective action, not only that we can, but that we have no choice as a practical matter but to do so.
Right.
If we not only love this country, but we want to bequeath it to our children and our children's children. I'm going to leave it at that. Thank you, Stella Morabito. I hope this will be the first of many conversations with you in 2023. We appreciate so much what you do. The book, The Weaponization of Loneliness, The Federalist. Come back to us again soon, if you would. I hope the rest of you will do the same again tomorrow. Same time, same station. Until then, I hope that you will go forth and multiply.